This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
Hello and welcome to this new episode on war, everyday life, and activism in St. Petersburg. And I'm very pleased to introduce you to our guest, Oleg Pachenkov. Oleg is a researcher who has been working a lot with activists in St. Petersburg and is now living in Berlin and working at the Georg Simmel Center of the Humboldt University. He has been involved previously with the Center for Independent Social Research as a research director in urban studies, and until last year, he was a researcher and consultant at the Center for Urbanism and Participation at the European University in St. Petersburg. So in the following, we shall speak about both his academic insights into urban studies in Russia, as well as some personal accounts and experiences with urban life and activism there. So, Oleg, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your relationship with St. Petersburg. I already introduced you with your academic affiliation. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what that entailed, your work with activists and civic associations, and what other kinds of professional involvements you've been engaged in St. Petersburg. And maybe then also what has brought you to Berlin.
Well, yeah, St. Petersburg is the city I've been living in since childhood. I've been, graduated there, and I've been working at the Center for Independent Social Research, which sounds academic, but in fact, it is an NGO. It's not like a state-owned or big research institute. It's a small, not private, but kind of private, non-for-profit research institute. Which was very, very typical, kind of representing a particular type of organizations that emerged in Russia after the collapse of Soviet Union, when the big academic institutions were like totally, state-owned and state-run, and developing particular agenda also in the science, in social science. And the Center for Independent Social Research emerged as with the aim to develop an alternative agenda. And there were several of such centers related to universities or independent from universities as like ours. So yeah, we have been working a lot on the qualitative sociology, so to say. And since the beginning, I didn't work a lot with migration. With urban studies, I was rather working with migration studies. But then actually I came to Berlin in 2006 and fell in love with the city and really focused on the urban studies here. And the city became an object of my research. So the first city I studied as urban studies researcher was Berlin, actually. And then I came to St. Petersburg back with lots of ideas about what urban studies can look like, because they basically did not exist in Russia by that time. It was 2006, 2007. And then also I came with a lot of ideas of educational or edutainment programs, because I was very much excited by the way that the citizens involved in urban activities in Berlin. So I was kind of dreaming about the same to happen in the city that I loved, my city of St. Petersburg. So me and my colleague, we initiated first like a non-academic educational program introducing interested citizens of St. Petersburg into urban issues. How you can think of the city, how you can act in the city. So it was, in collaboration with one art space. We did just a series of lectures during 2 years, like two times a month, with various speakers. And many speakers were actually brought from Berlin or from other European countries and cities. So this is how my involvement in urban issues started. So I was, since the beginning, I was not just a researcher, but also a kind of a person trying to, to be involved in some, let's say, civic activities, though I never called myself an activist. I worked with a lot with activists, but I think my research background or academic background kind of stopped me from calling myself an activist or even being an activist, because I think that the difference is that activists are those who know the truth, who know what has to happen, and the academics are people that are rather asking questions and are never sure. So I was helping to those who were sure. When I thought that what they are sure about, I agree with, kind of. Yeah, so, and of course, I mean, you know that urban studies agenda is very much influenced by the leftist intellectual thought. So, of course, it was, for this reason, working with the activists, it was always, kind of obvious. But then what happened, since the war started, I mean, the situation that is more known in the world outside of Russia is the aggression of Russia against the Ukraine. So kind of the geopolitical part of the story. But there is also another part of the story of what's going on within the country. And so the war is kind of, the situation of the war affected a lot the situation within the country. And the main effect is the growth of authoritarianism of Russia before was often called a hybrid regime, combining the authoritarian features or qualities with democratic institutions or like typical for democracies institutions or representative democracy, but also the institutions of direct democracy, of deliberative democracy, all coexisting with quite authoritarian things. But since the start of the war, the democratic, not institutions themselves, but activity was kind of cleaned up. It was closed. It was, not openly forbidden often, but repressed or suppressed. And as a reaction, many people left the country because they just couldn't perform their activities. So this the situation of repression and fear characterized the inner Russian situation in the last year. So I was among those who left the country in the spring of the last year when, I mean, we have been looking for the situation, the development of the situation for a few weeks, and we saw what was happening in those few weeks, and we just decided that we, because there are like dozens of people, my colleagues and friends, so we shared that, we talked a lot, we shared that experience, and the feeling was that we could not continue doing what we were doing because we would go, or saying what we wanted to say about the situation, because we would got arrested or go to prison, as some of our colleagues or friends did. So, I mean, staying inside the country and keeping silence was impossible, was a terrible feeling of self-censorship. So we didn't want to experience it. And and going to prison was also not a good option. So we decided to leave the country and to be open to think as the way we wanted, to talk the way we felt like, and also perhaps to reconsider our activities as citizens, as professionals, because of course it was a very strong feeling of, a guilt, but at least of responsibility. So as you know, active people, both as researchers, for example, as people from academia, and working people who have been working a lot with activism, so we believed that we were making our input in the building up civil society and public sphere in Russia. But so when all these things happened, and we've seen that the public sphere has been demolished within 2 weeks, we said, well, something, perhaps we did something wrong, or we didn't do what we had to, or we ignored some things. Well, like people said, or we said to ourselves, look, it's impossible that it happened within 2 weeks. Yeah, so we were kind of ignoring things that were happening during the last maybe 5 or even 10 years, kind of ignoring, trying to do our own things. And that was also a mistake, perhaps. So we needed a distance, yeah, to make a reflection on what we have been doing. So that was basically the reason to go out of Russia. So I came to Berlin because that was the city where I worked before and had colleagues and contacts.
Could you tell me a little bit more about the kind of obstacles that you encounters, the kind of like official or authoritarian resistance to the work you were doing in those first weeks after the war? So how did you feel it? How did it become recognizable?
Well, there was a wide range of things from the everyday life when you got this terrible signs, the Z letter, which became a symbol of the invasion of Russia into Ukraine. And it appeared all of a sudden everywhere, like posters, because, I mean, they're like social ads that is controlled by the city government. So they sell it to the business as ad spaces, but instead of selling it in the last spring, they just occupied them all themselves with all these state propaganda of Z symbols and all the slogans referring to the war and combining this actual invasion of Russia into Ukraine, this aggression of Russia with the brave history and memory of the Second World War, where Russian or Soviet Union soldiers were liberators, in a sense. So it was a total, like mess up of the meanings and senses and the faking up. So that was like at the daily life. So it was really, I mean, people didn't want to go out of their flats to the streets because they just didn't want to see these signs of militarization. And also there were like conflicts between people and like supporters of the war and those who were against. So there were clashes and conflicts all around. There was very bad feeling too, but there were also very, very strong direct and political things, like several colleagues were fired in universities. They were fired because they didn't sign the petitions, because there were many, but in the academic world, for example, there were famous like two tries signing petitions. One was the official one, started by the Minister of Education, and it was supposed to be signed by rectors of all universities. And rectors, of course, had to push and force their employees to sign it. So all the heads of departments and all this kind of these people had to sign, and they were supposed to force their employees, like and colleagues, just professors working the universities to sign it. So it was supposed to become a massive, of course, but there was at the same time a parallel. It was not massive. There were like hundreds of people signing it, and it's important to understand that there. In Russia, university is not. It's not a tradition of the free academia that you have in Europe. In Russia, university is a state institute. The rector of the university is not elected. The rector of the university is assigned by the Minister of Education. So he's a bureaucrat, basically. He's a representative of authoritarian executive power working for the ministry. So he either fires himself, leaves the position, or does what the ministry says. So it's not the decision of universities to sign at the level of rectors, but at the level of heads of departments and kind of like lower levels, of course, that's a personal decision. But people did not understand what the consequences if they sign, if they don't sign this official petition. So many did sign just because they didn't want to lose their position. Some did not sign and they lost their position. They were really kicked out, either from the position. So some colleagues, like close colleagues, friends of mine in St. Petersburg and Moscow universities, they didn't sign and they were, and they of course, they didn't deliver signs of their colleagues from their departments, for example, the heads of departments. So they were punished and they lost their position as heads of departments, became like ordinary professor or docent, like lecturer, or some were actually fired from the university. And there was also a scandal, like accused of the financial crime in one of the biggest Moscow universities against the people who we all knew as representatives of the like liberative liberal science, in like this liberal and Western oriented, let's say, wing in the academia. So they were accused for financial crime, and one like the leading person was actually arrested, and the other were became like what's the English word for they had to come to the police and report about their like involvement in this activity of this leading person. So many left the country even before it happened, just before the war. So it was a part of the same move of the repression. It started actually before the war, but with the war it became critical. So especially with the signing petitions, so people suffered if they didn't sign, and also suffered those who signed the alternative petition. There was a bottom-up initiative to sign petitions of academics against the war. It was much more numerous, actually, the people who signed it. And they also were punished. So many of them were punished. It was a decision of the rector each time, in each particular case. Some rectors were more harsh, some were more relaxed. But there were consequences. And just the last but not least example from my experience, we worked with a group of activists who were trying to make a park on the empty land, the Brachland in St. Petersburg. So it was, we have been working together for a couple of years trying to make transform a land into a park with the government, with the citizens, did events. So among, there were many like festival events to attract attention to the place. But as the war started, two of the activists from this group, they just made an anti-war event there at this space. So they were immediately arrested, both of them. And I was writing and signing, for example, a letter, so-called letter of reference or a recommendation letter, because the lawyers said that it could be a reason for the court to make a decision to let these people stay at home. Like at home, I don't know the proper legal words, but instead of staying, like waiting for the court decision in the prison, basically, they can stay at home, like a home arrest. Mm-hmm. So to be released from the prison, at least. And we did this letter, so we signed that letters, and it helped. So both of them were released and stayed at home for the waiting for the decision of the court. But and one of them, she just left the country. This is the next day, immediately. She went to Georgia, and the guy stayed for some reason, I don't know why. And finally, the guy got, I think, like 10 years of in prison. They are kind of, well, almost teenagers. Well, they are 20-something years old, and they made this anti-war protest. And now, well, yeah, she left, and he's in prison for 15 years.
Wow.
So this is just an example of what happened. And yes, there are some other examples of our close colleagues, activists, got arrested, and then another one spent, I think, almost a year in prison. then finally, I mean, the lawyers were trying coming to the court. It was just, you know, all this happened before the real, like, court decision for being guilty and got, you know, this or that number of years in the prison. So all this time before the court decision, which can be lasting for months now, and we see these cases. So the guys stay in the prison all this time. So another example of a colleague and a friend was that the lawyer was like constantly pushing and bringing in more and more asks and you know, signatures and reasons to the court to release the guy and to keep him arrested at home, not in the prison. And finally, she succeeded and he was released. And of course, he left the country the next day too, somehow. Nobody knows and nobody explains how it happens, but we know that there are NGOs working for like illegal evacuation of people under danger outside of Russian boundaries. So this kind of thing happening. And so you really can feel that you're in absolutely real, not an abstract danger. And the most terrible thing, I guess, is it's a gray zone. It's unclear for what you can be detained or sent to a prison for or not, for which word, for which gesture in your social network. Yeah, if you use the word war, yes, there were many cases. Yeah, when people just used the word war in their like posts in Facebook or similar social networks, they got fined with saying that if they do that next time, they go to prison. All these kind of things, they really make your life terrible because you don't understand what you can say, what you can't. And it's a situation of like, you're nervous all the time because you don't know what to do, how to behave.
Yeah, thank you, Oleg, for that. For that description, that very vivid description. We shall talk about the current situation in St. Petersburg as you experienced it on your last visit in April in a moment. I'd like to ask you now a little bit about urban studies as it has been institutionalized in Russia, you said, in 2006, when you came back to St. Petersburg, there was virtually no such framework for studies, framework of research that you then also helped develop in Russia. So, for our listeners more familiar with the Anglo-Saxon version of urban studies, how would you describe the urban studies as you have experienced them or been part of in Russia? What kind of trends, questions, and approaches predominate? How has it changed over the last couple of years, and particularly now over the last year with the war?
Well, to describe the entire picture would be difficult because country is huge, and it's also spread. Yeah, so we have big cities across the country, and in each big city you have several universities. You still have universities in smaller cities, so it's like it's very wide spread. And actually, the Anglo-Saxon, ironically, exactly Anglo-Saxon tradition influenced urban studies in Russia, because one of the first departments of urban studies was established in the independent high school in Moscow. It was also like NGO, in private kind of private/NGO university in Moscow, where they made, it's called Shaninka after the name of the rector and establisher of it, Theodor Shanin, who is a British scholar, actually. of Russian origin, and he established this high school in Moscow, and they made a program in urban studies together with the Manchester University, and it was one of the first these kind of programs. And then it's an interesting thing. Actually, I would say that the urban studies as a field has not been very much developed in Russia. There were several also local kind of traditions in schools in Ural or Siberian universities, but not that many. The trend, like the trend setters, were always Moscow, to a lesser degree St. Petersburg, mainly Moscow, because in Moscow there were three big hubs of education related to the urban issues. But I would say that only one of them was properly urban studies, in a way that in a meaning that it has in the like Western or scientific vocabulary. It was this program at Shanyanka School, because there was also a program, even a department called Higher School of Urbanism or Urbanistic in a bigger, one of the biggest universities of Russia, which is Higher School of Economics. So within that, it was kind of a department called High School of Urbanistic, but it was more run by urban planners or geographers then. So, and very much connected to the state government. So they were kind of training people in the governance of urban governance, let's say, rather than urban studies. And the third big hub and the big actor was the private school, like properly private school of urban design and urbanism, Strelka, so-called. And it was established by business people in a close collaboration with architects. And Rem Kolkhoz was one of the first advisors and teachers in this school. And this school was also created, you know, very much focused actually on urban planning and architecture applied. So it was science, but applied science in the beginning. And also Strelka Institute had a very strong department called Bureau Strelka, which was basically doing things here. It was not educational part, but doing urban planning and architecture. So it characterized a lot the situation with urbanism in Russia, because it was always very little of research and intellectual debate around it. There was some, but I would say very little. And even actually many people who were interested in urban studies and were doing kind of urban studies, making research, publishing, getting their PhDs in this field, many of them actually left the country and continued their work in European or American universities. And within Russia, there were very, very few examples of proper urban studies. There were some examples in the further universities in Ural or Siberia or Far East, where urban research was very closely connected to the historical department, for example, or ethnography. So they worked somewhere at the kind of interdisciplinary edge of urban studies and history, urban studies and ethnography, this kind of things. Or, for example, migration studies, somehow where it already existed before, a strong school of migration studies, like in Irkutsk. They kind of added urban dimension to their research. But the overall, the trend was formulated for the entire country, was formulated, I would say, in Moscow. And in Moscow, as I just described, it was always very much applied-oriented science. And I think it determined the situation in this field in Russia overall. So it's very little of science, actually, and much of applied activity much, of a lot of applied work, several programs training people, not studying the cities, not in studying the cities, but in even in studying, if in studying, then applied studies for planning and architecture. So since the emergence, the urban study field immediately was kind of split, and some parts of it developed more than the others. So I would say academic part developed the least, applied part connected to the governance developed much more. Another part related to applied urban planning and architecture for the city, for the state, or for private developers developed. These two sides, kind of parts of the field developed much more. And this is the situation still. And since the beginning of the war, let's say in those two developed parts, little things happened, basically nothing, because ironically, life continued, the city still existed. The departments, the ministries, the departments of the city government responsible for city governance, they nothing happened to them, they still exist. Somebody has to govern the cities, somebody has to plan the cities. Somebody has to sign the papers for continuing construction and doing architecture. So in this field, not many things changed. In the applied planning architecture work with the developers, the same. Yeah, I mean, developers still continue working. They had some financial troubles, but business can always, solve the troubles. So they are solving, and architects still are in need. Yeah, so there is a construction. They continue building buildings. So why not to work with them? So these two fields are continuing. So I didn't mention actually the fourth part, which is urban studies connected to the civil society and the urban activism. So apart from three I mentioned, this was a fourth one also existing and developing. And this one, I think, suffered the most, as well as academia too. So in academia, it was never easy to do research on the critical things in urban studies. So to do works to defend your PhD thesis in the field of abstract theory of urban studies or social theory related to urban issues was fine. Or something in urban governance was also fine. But critical thinking was difficult. You could do that, but you could even publish. There was no censorship, basically. But there was censorship at the level of defending your PhD thesis, for example. So there it was not that easy. And to be openly critical, even though from the academic point of view or philosophical point of view, would be difficult. So, be critical against neoliberalism was possible. Be critical against the liberalism or authoritarianism in a particular country at the level of defending your thesis was not, you would be recommended by your supervisor not to include those theses in your final thesis, these ideas openly, because it can cause troubles, and nobody wants troubles at the defense of PhD thesis. So this kind of situation, but there was no censorship. You could publish in journals basically everything, and then people did. Since the war started, we talked to the colleagues who stayed in the country, and they said, look, it was not like the open censorship again. It's like the gray zone I mentioned. In the everyday life, the same in academia. People did not understand what topic they could work on and which topic they couldn't. And it was somehow connected to the situation in the activism. In the first months since the war started, last spring and summer, it looked like that the activism and the activist energy of those who didn't leave the country they said, well, we still feel like we can act. We probably cannot act in the fields or topics which are considered to be political by the state, by the government. But we could do, for example, in the ecological issues. And there was kind of a boom of the ecological and heritage protection activism in last summer. So people felt that they could not go open to the streets to protest against the war, but they could go to protest against the demolition of the historical building for a while. The same with ecological issues. They could go and protest against the cutting of the trees or making another huge dump next to the city or these kind of things. People did, and for a while nothing happened. So the police or all the violent machine was more focused on preventing the political protests. But then, as it became clear that there would be no political protests anymore, because of cruel violence against the participants, then slightly the violent machine turned towards any other kind of protests or civic open public civic movements, and interestingly, it became the situation with these ideological control and repression. It was used by the business, because what stays behind the demolition of cultural heritage buildings or making another harm to the environmental issues, what stays behind that usually is business interest of developers or some other business doing some things in the environmental field. So the business started using or abusing the situation with the violent machine ready to operate to kind of express its violence against the protesters. The business started using the situation kind of reporting on the activists, really writing reports or calling to police saying, look, this is an activist in cultural heritage protection, for example, famous person organizing lots of events and protests, trying to save building from demolitions. Developers hate him. So developers just checked his Facebook page and said, and called the police and said, look what he's publishing on his web page, Facebook page. This is, you really can take this text and send him to prison for 15 years with a new law, because there were two new laws published. Exactly, aiming at people who use, these particular language formulations, the anti-war rhetorics, so to say. So that was anti-war rhetorics on his webpage, Facebook page. So he was immediately arrested, and they talked to him and released him. So he was just fined for the first time. But then they also told that if it happens next time, you can go to prison for a few years. So it was just a try to use the current situation against the activists in different fields, and the same bad things happened to the protests in the ecological activists. So the people just went out to the streets to protest against some ecological issues, and then the police came and behaved against them violently, as exactly in the same way as did against the political protesters, because they don't make a difference. Yeah, they see people on the streets protesting, they just do what they do, what they're trained for. So slightly people realized within Russia that actually no public or open protest is now possible, because it will be immediately treated as partly political, or anyway, now that this violent machine is behaving as it does, so without making differences. So I think this enthusiasm about the opportunities to transform your activist activities to another fields and urban issues looked like kind of neutral field, but not anymore. On the other hand, activists themselves, if they're responsible and thinking smart people, as there are, they cannot ignore the fact and just pretend there's nothing happening, there's no war, let's continue business as usual, let's, you know, think of, you know, making urban environment comfortable. Activists don't do that. The people working for the state does that. Architects do that, many. Urban planners do. So there is a big program, for example, of the state-run program, that, like, from the highest level, curated by the Ministry of Construction, the program of participatory planning and design of urban public spaces. So every year the state, the federal government gives lots of money to the small towns in Russia to fix their public spaces. And the procedure of like planning and design is supposed to be done in according to the participatory planning mechanisms and with tools of participatory planning. And it's still going on. It was not restricted. People are called to come. So you cannot go to protest on the streets or in the park, but you are welcome to come to the office of the architect to plan this park together with citizens. So it's like a total like nonsense and collapse and clash in terms of like ideological and issues and values staying behind it, but not for everyone. For many architects and people even involved in this, like moderating these participatory planning sessions for design of public spaces, they continue doing that. And they say, why not? I mean, cities are here, citizens are there. People still, you know, stay there, they walk, they need parks to go out, and the environment better be comfortable than non-comfortable. Because people don't deserve, yeah, the bad urban environment. Why should we stop doing what we have been doing? And there is no connection, yeah, to the, well, people say to the war, but, you know, okay, perhaps to the war, no connection. But, I mean, in your professional activity, as a citizen, you still cannot ignore it. Should not. But as a professional, you still cannot ignore the fact that of the repressions. So what for you? You design your public spaces. It's public spaces for public life, but what is public life then if you cannot go and express your opinion publicly and you'll get arrested? So, but these kind of things people just do not connect often. Mm-hmm. Some do, and they're in trouble, or they leave the country, or they stop doing, and now kind of took a pause and trying to rethink actually how the professional activity can look like in this new situation, mm-hmm. what they should do, what they shouldn't do in these new conditions. So that's now a big question mark for a big part of professional community in urban issues, let's say, not only studies. Yeah, studies you also can continue. You're not sure you can publish it. For sure not in foreign journals. That's another part of the story. Yeah, the strange politics of sanctions against Russian scholars who are not allowed to publish now in English-speaking journals, are not allowed to, you know, to not invited into research projects anymore. So that this is absolutely strange things, and I guess that it's against the values of academia, basically. So even Russian scholars continue their research, the English-speaking audience will not know anything about that, because if they publish, they only can publish within Russia. And if there will be censorship, then some topics will just disappear, because it could be possible to publish it outside of the country in English journal, but not in Russia, in Russian language. But now with the sanctions, they cannot publish it at all. So I think the sanctions will actually affect the urban studies, the critical urban studies, because there will be no space for critical urban studies results of this research to become publicly accessible.
How is that? How are these sanctions from international journals? How are they formulated, or how they are articulated? Is it like a straight refusal to publish from scholars who are still at Russian universities?
It sounds like there could be no collaboration in any way with people affiliated with Russian institutions. Mm. any sort of institutions. First of all, universities, because they're state institutions. But for example, university where I work, it's European University, which is a private university, again, NGO. So it's not state university. It has always been in troubles with the state, actually. It's been closed a couple of times by the state. But still, it's a Russian institution. So it goes under this requirement of no collaboration with Russian institutions. So if I only had my affiliation in the European University of St. Petersburg, I could not be published in any journal in Europe or the States. So the colleagues who stay and have affiliation in Russia cannot publish, cannot be part of the research projects. The research projects were frozen or closed. Several projects that I was a part of, for example, the funding has been frozen. So no money can go to people, scholars affiliated with Russian institutions. So only those who have affiliation in institutions outside of Russia, they can have access to the world academic public stage. So like me, because I work here in Berlin. But so that's tricky. It perhaps will change because the level of European Union, actually that's a European requirement. So there are some negotiations now going on at the European Commission level, because for scholars, it's quite obvious that these sanctions is an insane. And they actually contradict to the academic values, obviously and openly. Because academia should come over the political national boundaries and over political agenda or geopolitical agenda imposed to it. Yeah, so the solidarity of academics is supposed to be about the support of people who suffer the repression in authoritarian regimes, not the opposite. So I think these debates are now going on and hopefully the situation will change. But I think the problem is you have to apply some, you have to be very selectional then. Yeah, so it's much easier to just ban all, without any details, just all. To let things happen, you have to go into details and, check which of two petitions this academic actually signed. Though there are people who signed both, I know that, but very few. But it's still, for those who have been living under authoritarian regimes, it's quite obvious. One you sign sincerely, the other one you sign because you don't want to be fired, because if you are fired, you lose your job, you lose your salary, you lose everything, you lose your professional track, basically. So it can be understood, in a way. But there are many scientists who didn't sign this pro-war petition, and they signed, and their name are visible, and they signed the anti-war petition. Why do you ban those people? Mm-hmm. That's strange.
What happened to the to your colleagues at the Center for Independent Social Research, as well as the European University, particularly in the Center for Urbanism and Participation? So how many of those stayed or still in St. Petersburg, and how many of those have left the country?
Well, my feeling is that from my professional circle, both academic and activists, my feeling is that 80% have left the country. Because, in our center it was not big. There were just, four people working. Yeah, it's now one stays in Russia, the director of the center. So he takes care of the business, so to say. Other centers, I also know they lost most of their employees. In Center for Independent Social Research, I think also 80%. So I came in this April, so 1 year after the war started, I came to the Center for Independent Social Research, and there were maybe 10 people or maybe 5 people, because there were also guests, some colleagues coming from other institutions. So yeah, most of people left. All I think all those who had established relations, international relations with colleagues outside of Russia, they left because they speak English, they have established relations, they have colleagues who welcome them, and this should be actually recognized and stressed that at the personal level. I think none of us have experienced anything related to the sanctions or something like that. So at a personal level, all foreign colleagues helped us. And then they found money, short-term scholarships, long-term scholarships, any sort of support that helped us to come and stay now for a year, perhaps for a longer time, in European or American or Canadian universities. So, yeah, for those who had established relations, they left. Still many people stayed, especially those who feel responsibility, who had administrative positions, like heads of departments, for example, or some other like units. Because if they leave, then the entire team just lose the leader and then disappears. So they kind of feel responsibility for their colleagues, and that's why they stay and keep positions to continue doing things well. They also, of course, we all share the belief that there should be some, you know, science, like critical science, still developing within the country, because if all scholars leave, then what you get? There will be no academia anymore. There should be public and civic activity going on, because if there will be just nothing and then like 100% of this field just, you know, cleaned up and taken by the authoritarian state, then there will be no chances for any restoration of normal society, even after the end of the regime, which we all hope for. But when it happens, there will be a need for alternative institutions to be developed. But to develop something, you should have it. It's much more difficult to develop from scratch, from nothing. Even the Soviet Union, at the moment of collapse Soviet Union, there were, if not institutions, then at least initiatives, groups, personalities who became a background and a kind of a key person for the development of democracy after the totalitarianism. So the same will be needed now, yeah, for the time when the Putin's regime collapses. So we all believe that this kind of work and activity is needed. And from my feeling, maybe 90% of those 80% who left, let's say, they all are looking back to Russia and thinking of coming back to Russia as soon as possible, as soon as they can afford it. What it means, it differs from a person to person. So for, I mean, like the expectations or conditions that they would consider kind of enough for them to come back differ from one person to another. So some say, just the stop of the war perhaps is enough, or stop of the war and stop of the like hard repressions that are taking place now. Some say, no, we only come after Putin is gone. No way we're going to work under this regime. So it differs. But all people, most of people really think that they need to work, to act, to change their society, the Russian society that they have been working for and investing so much of intellect, energy, and everything, and scholars and activists. So they actually want to come and do some good for Russia.
How do you keep track of the developments in St. Petersburg and beyond in Russia? How do you get a sense of urban life and the situation there?
Well, the overall feeling was, I think, well, it was mixed feeling. I think the society is split very much now, openly split, and into like two big parts, so to say. One part is those who don't care, who either believe that the war Russia is doing is a good thing, because, I mean, who believe to propaganda, and propaganda is saying that Russia is liberating Ukraine from fascists, and then many people believe in that, and so they either don't care about the war, support the war, but supporters, I think, are much fewer. Most of people just say, well, we are here, the war is there, perhaps there is some right thing staying behind this invasion, because Ukrainians did bad things against Russian-speaking population, and we are protecting those people. So there was some good, there is definitely some wrong and bad things about the war, like any war. Killing people is no good. Destroying the cities is no good, but they share this formula. Russia was forced to do it. So they say, okay, we don't care. We just live our lives, and it's possible to continue living your life. If you just work, you know, I know it's some manual work or in the office or in a business, you just continue doing your job, and then you after work you go to buy food and go home and watch films on Netflix. Well, Netflix is not accessible anymore. That's the problem. So you cannot buy. You can go to McDonald's. You cannot watch Netflix. There are some troubles. Yeah, you cannot buy some brands, clothes. But otherwise, yeah, you can eat different food. You can eat Russian burgers, drink Russian beer or lemonade instead of Coke, and watch not Netflix, but, I don't know, some other. Well, people still find a way to get access to Western films. And entertain themselves in pretty much the same way as they did before. And yeah, so this is normal life. And we were kind of, when we came, we were just really shocked, because for us, the life is not normal. It's not like, yeah, for us, the time kind of particular history of everything, of our lives, of the country life, the history of the country, of the world, has changed drastically in the February of the last year. But for many people, it just didn't. And that was a shock. And the other impression was like those who care about what's going on but could not leave the country for personal reason or financial reason or other reasons, they are very much depressed because of, well, this is obvious feeling. This is the feeling that we didn't want to experience and left. That's why we left the country, because you cannot act, you cannot think, you cannot talk in a way you wish. Not at all. I mean, in principle, you can, if you don't touch the political issues or the war issues, which is difficult if you are a reflexive thinking person. So, well, this feeling of self-censorship, as I already mentioned, is a terrible feeling. It's really a psychological, if not psychiatric, feeling. It's like somebody is living or kind of invading in your brains, in your mind, in your psychic, and behaving instead of you. It's a terrible feeling. And people still feel it. Or they just closed from the rest of the world. The difference with the situation a year ago when the war just started, the similarity is the silence. As it's a very important feeling and action, or the non-action of talking. The silence is one of the dominant category, I would say, in the Russian society now. It's still there. So this similarity, yeah, for 1 year it didn't change much, but the difference is that when a year ago the silence was caused by the situation that you didn't understand to whom to talk without taking a risk of provoking a conflict or even getting arrested, because there were cases that people just reported on the neighbors or the neighboring table in the bar where the guys are discussing the anti-war position. Then the people from the next table just called to police to say that they are like betrayers, arrest them. So this kind of thing, they're happening. But now people understand better whose position is what. They know among the friends, relatives, colleagues, who supports the war, who doesn't support the war. So they don't talk about their opinion about the war, the political situation, to those who they know don't share their position. So this is kind of, now this is institutionalized split of society. And so keep silence with those who don't share your position, or you talk about different things like daily life, routine, nothing more. And with the very few people with who you share your, you can share your opinion, you can talk about that. But anyway, it's all, you know, these talks are depressive in a way, because what can you talk? You can just complain, you can criticize, but you don't see any space for any productive action that can change the situation. People do not see how they themselves can make an input in changing the situation, apart from what the activists do. Is, I think they all now invest all the efforts and energy in keeping the networks and keeping the mutual support. So those who stay in the country, they are now in kind of hibernation regime, so to say, so they cannot act properly, but they at least try to keep the safe space for those who are against the war. They even still continue doing some activities, like, for example, they copied the formats that existed in the Soviet Union, and it was called Kvartirnik. Kvartira is a flat apartment. So people did, for example, all rock musicians were performing in this format of Kvartirniki in the Soviet Union times, because they were critical towards regime. They were not allowed to perform in on the stage, so they were playing for their fans in apartments of friends and so on. So that was a very known format, and now it's back again. So the activists come and talk, discuss the war, the political situation, what they want to discuss, in the format of meetings at apartments of friends, without any, of course, announcements, anything. And people just invite each other personally. So you only invite people who you trust. And so social media play a significant role in that, like social networks and other like apps. They're used for this networking. So people continue keeping, it's a very, very small and thin layer, I would say, of this activity compared to how it looked like a year ago, 2 years ago. But it still exists. And people are really trying to keep it, not to let it disappear totally.
So that was now back in April that you went back to St. Petersburg to visit again. What were your feelings or your expectations when you got there?
I didn't have expectations, actually. I had a personal task and a professional interest, I would say. So, there was one expectation, actually. I expected that from inside it looks not that terrible as from outside, which we all know about anything. Like when you live in another city than your parents and they watch TV, then they call you sometime and say, what the hell, what terrible things going on in your city? It could be even in the same country. Well, if you live abroad, it's even worse. Yeah, so it's always the news always exaggerating the situation. So people who left the country, and foreigners obviously watching TVs, watching news or listening to news, of course know only part of the story that is delivered, and it's delivered for a particular reason, with a goal, yeah, to frighten, to keep the awareness, to keep the particular attitude, whatever, yeah. So media are serving particular goals, yeah, definitely. So if you only know situation from the media, you have just part of the story, and it is definitely very, very emotionally kind of charged, so to say. So I had that guess that when I would come to Russia, and from inside it would look more neutral, so to say, not that terrible in some sense, which was, yeah, partly true, as I said. So when you just, you know, land and you go into the city and you look around, you had this strange feeling that nothing has changed. It's all the same as before. So yeah, that was expectation. But the interest was, I actually wanted to understand what's going on, how the country and the city continues living, what happened to that split of society, as I said. Because, yeah, a year ago it was like constant clashes with people, so people just stopped communicating to avoid clashes. Now it's all set. People understand who is where, who is who. So it's now functioning better. Different, because you don't communicate with many people with who you did. Now you just stop doing that. But at least no, you know, conflicts provoking your constant emotional, you know, instability, so to say. So people cannot live in that situation. So and I was looking to learn and understand how it works, the society as such, and how the activist sector actually works. So yeah, and discovered some things, and the personal thing was to come to the feeling that leaving the country is my own choice, because before it was very bad feeling of being kicked out, which is no good when you feel that somebody pushed you out of your lovely, you know, city, not country. I wouldn't call that country my lovely, but the city definitely. I did want to leave my city, but I had to, and this feeling of a victim was not good. So personally, it was very important to come to look at the situation and make a conscious decision, either to stay or come back soon, or to leave, but on your own decision. So it also worked, I think. We came, we looked around, we realized that 80% of our professional or personal circles, milieu, just left. So we realized we could not continue our life. I mean, when you leave the country, you always leave, you continue living abroad with the dream of the city and the life that you left behind. So when you kind of regret about what you've lost, you always have an image of that dream, but and it hurts, especially if you liked that situation, that conditions that you had to live behind. But then we came now and we realized it's just a dream. We would not be able to you know, continue living that way of life that we did before the February 2022. The life now looks different. The city looks different. There are no people, because most of your life is people with who you work, with who you communicate, with who you hang out, with who you talk, share thoughts. None of that is possible now. It's just a few colleagues, depressed relatives who don't care, and that's why you actually cannot communicate with them properly. It's very reduced, and if all the time very nervous way of communication with you, all the time care about not crossing the particular border because you don't want to make conflict in the family, and this is it. All the activities like my activist part of my professional activity, working with activism, is not possible working for the state is absolutely unacceptable for me now. Working in the university is probably the only thing that would make sense, because education still is valid, and it's really needed to continue educating people, educating young people. So that probably now the only type of activity that I would value and would probably come back for to Russia. But it's also dangerous in a way, because there were examples of students reporting to their teachers, about their teachers to the police, because teachers and students didn't share the opinion about the political situation and the war. So it's also kind of tricky situation. And I think what is needed is actually reconsidering the way I can act as a professional in Russian context, and come sooner or later, come back and act in this new way, which I should reinvent for myself.
We shall have in a couple of weeks or so a conversation with you and some other colleagues, also expats from Russia, talking about the complications around building transnational networks, including also people in Russia. So we shall have a more focused discussion on that. But maybe could you give us some ideas about how do you find communicating with your colleagues who stayed behind in Russia? Do you get a good sense of what's going on through this discussion? Is there an open communication possible?
Actually, I would say not. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to come physically to Russia. I didn't feel safe, but I still thought that I had to do that professionally in order to understand the real situation, because, well, that's a methodological point. All social scientists know that just interviewing is not enough. There is lots of information about the situation that you don't get in a talk with a person. You have to feel it somehow, to be there, to behave, to observe, so on. So I wanted to come, but also I realized this past year that talking to people who stays within Russia is difficult. I remember my own experience before I left the country. I controlled very much my language. So when I talked, I didn't use some words, or I was actually all the time thinking what situation I am, and didn't use some words that could cause some bad consequences. So actually, when you talk to people, well, we made several tries of Zoom talks with those who stayed in Russia, and it was not satisfying for me neither. I all the time had a feeling that people, the people who stays in Russia, they actually talk in a different way. They talk in a, we call that Zopus language, like referring to the proper pronunciation, the ancient Greek writer who was writing Zopus, who was writing these like fairy tales, actually describing their society and criticizing the weaknesses and the bad things in the society, but in a fairy tale form, not direct. So we were all trained very well in this language in the Soviet Union, where people used it a lot in also in culture, in arts, in writings, in cartoons, in many ways. So we know that we have that skill still. Me at least, yeah, as a Soviet generation representative. So people are learning it, those who don't have that skill, they're learning it now, how to talk about things without naming them. And this is the way that the people who stays in Russia talk to you when you're here. And it's such a strange feeling, and also a bad feeling of inequality. Because I was actually even kind of blamed for that a little by colleagues, because it was even at a conference, like hybrid format. So some people stayed within Russia. I was speaking in a Zoom. And I was using terms, well, I of course I also control my language, and I didn't use like the proper sometimes, so I didn't speak in an aggressive way or really in a way that would cause some troubles for the conference. I mean, it could be closed next day. It was supposed to last for 3 days. If on the first talk I use, you know, those forbidden formulas, then probably the conference or the section would be just closed next day, and people staying in Russia would be in trouble with the police or intelligence service listening, I mean, or filtering the internet for particular formulas, in other words. So I didn't use many of them, but I still, the way I was speaking, it kind of triggered people staying inside Russia, and they were complaining and blaming me, saying, you shouldn't do that because we stay in Russia and you're outside. And we felt it like expression of inequality, because you felt you were allowed to speak in a way that we could not speak. And I said, well, okay, well, but what, I mean, yeah, this is inequality, but that's a structural inequality in a way, mm-hmm. on the one hand. And on the second hand, well, I think that things, these thoughts, these ideas had to be pronounced. If they're not pronounced, then we just play for regime. We support it without keeping silence, without not saying that, we just support it. And I understand and I respect that you cannot say that being inside Russia, because you're in danger or risk. But I'm not, so I have the privilege, but I'm using that privilege not for my, not for myself. I'm using that privilege as I'm making an input in the development of the public debate, so to say, to exist. You cannot do that. I can. So you kind of delegate it to me, and we both make an input in its development. So if I wouldn't do that, yeah, there would be no, it would be equality, but inequality in what? In being suppressed. So that's just an example of how difficult the communication can be now. And unfortunately, this feeling of a little tension and exists between those who left and those who stay. And those who stay, they kind of feel that those who left are guilty for living, for kind of guilty for leaving those who stay behind, being privileged, which is in many ways not true, because those who left also feel they're privileged, because they at least could escape this nightmare in one sense, but they've experienced lots of troubles and still experience, of course. Being a migrant is not an easy thing. And in this situation, we all were almost in a situation of refugees or forced migrants, at least. People ran out, I mean, with hand baggage for absolutely unpredictable time. And they came with no money, with no working credit cards, because Russian credit cards were banned and blocked. So people came, you know, nowhere without any stable position yet. So it was all kind of, people have been establishing it during the year. But when they came to nothing. So there were many, many, many technical troubles. And the very decision of like leaving all your life behind without preparing any kind of further steps of your life, which is just unpredictability in front of you. But people jumped in it, so it was kind of brave too. But both sides felt that those who left were privileged. So it was kind of a bad taste to complain about your being in, you know, technical administrative troubles in Germany. To complain and to, you know, to say to those who stayed, look, we are also not in very good situations. We kept silence about that. So we were trying to support those who stay and invested lots of, you know, financial, emotional efforts in supporting them. So this inequality actually is seen as inequality, I think, by both sides. And Those who left are seen as privileged, those who stayed as unprivileged. Mm-hmm. And it affects the communication in a way.
Mm-hmm. I'm very struck by your account of the dramatic turn of events in your personal life and in the life of your professional networks and circles. And then also your statement that when you came back, it looked like as if the city is operating as before, as if nothing had happened. And maybe adding on to this, I mean, one aspect that also I'm wondering is about what effects does the news or the accounts of fallen soldiers in the war, fallen Russian soldiers, have in public discourse, in media representations? No? What effects does it have for people still living there? I mean, what about the threat of conscription into the war, particularly for men like you, maybe?
That's an issue. Well, about the victims, I think it's often underestimated. The propaganda machine is underestimated often. I think it works properly in Russia now. It's just, this is very efficient, unfortunately. So it is included in the propaganda in a very well way, in a very functional way, because, I mean, it's quite obvious for all, you know, scholars familiar with the nationalism studies, for example. I think the Benedict Anderson described this in Imagined Communities very well, the idea of the unknown soldier. A non-soldier is a figure that is very much needed for construction of imagined community. It's just an abstract soldier representing the community. And it's like bravest features, so to say, parts. So that's the same with these victims. I mean, the propaganda built like direct connection between the memory of the Second World War and the current war in Ukraine. So the victims of this current war are presented exactly in the same way as the victims of the heroes who died in the Second World War, for example. Or there were also the other wars in between. There always were wars, yeah, that Soviet Union and then Russia was kind of involved in more or less obvious ways. So there was Afghan war, and there were also heroes, like properly presented as heroes. And many of them are actually now are officers or instructors or volunteers at the Ukraine war. There were Chechnya war with its own heroes saving the country and the residents of the country from terrorists. So this narrative of heroes, it has always been existing. So these are just new heroes in this pantheon. So to say. So it works for the support of regime, obviously. New heroes. You can see these pictures everywhere. Some still alive, some dead, even more honored. So it doesn't provoke any negative effect as some would expect. Like, I mean, you would expect the negative effect in terms of the human life values. Like, human lives are sacrificed to the state, but the propaganda is actually presenting it as confirming, saying yes, the personal life are sacrificed to the bigger community and the bigger, higher value than the personal life, which is very, in a way, sociological idea. Yeah, of like the society has always been built around that. Yeah, the society means more than the individual. So it works. And there is a movement of mothers of the soldiers. Of course, this is a critical movement. But as far as I could understand, even not all members of that movement are critical against the regime. So in ideological terms, so some just want to take care of their children. So very pragmatic kind of, or very natural idea without any ideology behind it. I think very few, even mothers involved in that, kind of formulate their position as a political protest against making a war. They rather, I think, to be efficient, and the goal is to save the lives of their children or to increase the quality of the conditions that their children are in the front line. So this is their main goal, and the rest is just serving it. So to be efficient in reaching that goal, they kind of sacrifice the political argumentation. I think I've read kind of comments on that, interviews with the representatives of this mothers' movement saying, we want to save our children. Even if we are against the war, we would not say that publicly, because if we say that, then the state representatives wouldn't listen to us, because they would say we are enemies. Who listens to enemy? We shouldn't look like enemies to reach our main goal. So to be efficient, so that's one thing. The men are very much afraid, and the families are afraid, but it's also treated more pragmatically. Some do, some really do, like they're so ideologically brainwashed that they're ready to send their children to the war because they believe that this is a right war. And it could be even described and interpreted in the ancient terms of the honor, like ancient Greek terms of honor. To be a citizen means to have an honor, and to sacrifice your life to a polis was the highest honor you could get. So that's pretty much the same attitude. So there are like scandals and clashes in the families when like young men left the country to avoid it, the call-up, then the mothers were blaming them for being betrayers of the country. It really happened. Few examples, but they exist. In most of cases, if we compare the numbers, yes, there was a huge flow of young men in the last fall. It was September, I think, when they were calling up people to the war. Then, it was huge flow to where you can go even without a passport, like Armenia or Georgia, which the border was open. So families were sending their children out of the country, but it did not turn into any political claim. It was just a very pragmatic decision. I just want to save your boy from going to the front line. This is it. And actually, I think, but we can actually better ask those colleagues living in Georgia, for example. But my feeling was that there was also, I know it from German experience, because some also left to Germany or other European countries at that time, not in the spring, but in the fall. So there was kind of two waves of refuge from Russia since the war started. And I think that there is a kind of suspicion and tension also between these two waves, because the first wave is considered political. The first wave of the spring was the wave of those who disagree with the situation and are not ready to leave and act and continue doing whatever under this new regime, because the situation has changed. It's not the same regime as was in Russia before. So under this regime, they're not ready to leave. So that was political decision, and they left. The second wave in the fall was just pragmatic wave of those who don't want to go to the war. Well, there was a little of, or some, not little, that's not fair, but there was some political statement behind it too. people are saying, well, those who don't want to go to the war, they didn't want to participate in the war, they didn't want to kill people. What's wrong or strange about it? It's obvious. So we should support these people, because what they do is also has some political implication. You know, like refusing to kill other people or to participate in the war is, it is political claim, so to say. I guess that's true. But I really wonder or even doubt about that. Many people who were just, you know, trying to escape it were really thinking in those political terms. I think most of it was rather pragmatic driven. I mean, you want to live your life. You don't want to go to the army. Or definitely you don't want to kill people neither. But I think it was, my guess, it was more pragmatic. But ironically, for example, in Georgia, the effect was the opposite from the perception from the locals was the opposite. Because the first wave of the spring, even though it was political, but it was also a wave of, as we just discussed, more privileged, so to say, economically privileged. It was also prepared in Georgia by the previous wave before the war, the wave of the IT specialists, because many companies were already kind of feeling that the situation is moving towards the war, or anyway, some bad kind of conflict. And many companies started to moving out their personnel out of Russia. And Georgia was just a very attractive destination point for many reasons, a different story. But anyway, what was the perception in Georgia was that the first wave in spring, so IT people were also a big portion of it, actually. So many, because many companies said, okay, we stop working with Russia. That's a part of sanctions. So if you want to continue working for our company, you leave the country. And we prepare a space for you where you can go. It could be Europe, could be Turkey, could be Caucasus for Russian citizens, easy, because it's Russian speaking and so on. So yeah, many people came. So they came, the IT specialists, well-paid people, or many people came from Moscow or St. Petersburg or other big cities for political reasons, but still they were not the poorest people in the country. Because if you're poor, you cannot buy tickets to fly, because tickets were like, they costed a lot by that time, because there was a very high demand. So yeah, people did it, and they looked wealthy for a local population, or they were actually wealthier than the local population. And so locals look at them in class terms and say, what the look at them. They call them refugees, but they came with them. Some came with good cars. Some came saving their salaries in IT companies, or some came saving their jobs in Russia, like many architects did. They left the country for political / pragmatic reasons, but they continue working in Russia, I don't know, making sketches or planning or projecting some architectural stuff. So, and they earn money, they earn the Moscow salaries, for example, which is several times higher than the average Tbilisi salary. Mm-hmm. So in class terms, they are hated, because they also cause gentrification, obviously. And the second wave looked so really, it was house, it was mess. I mean, the fall wave of people running out of the call-up, the army. And it was just young people absolutely, you know, running away without anything prepared at all, without money, without food, without a place to stay, just terrible conditions. That really looked like refugee situation. So the attitude of the Georgians, for example, towards these people was better, because they looked like refugees needed help. Mm-hmm. While the first wave looked like wealthy, rich yuppies coming to gentrify Tbilisi. Yeah, so that's from two different perspectives, you interpret these two situations differently.
Yeah, we shall talk about this, I guess, in the next conversation. Let me
All right, then. So moving now into the present. So how do you feel about your current situation as scholar, and what are your plans for the future?
Well, I'm lucky and privileged because I actually have a stable position now in Berlin for at least 2 years, and some plans in collaboration for the further a couple of years. But in terms of topics, I would say, well, a research topic would be, for me, I think now I really feel a strong need to reconsider my previous activity and to become a bit more academic than practical, because for many years I have been more involved in practical activity, and as many as my other colleagues did not, you know, underestimate it, so to say, the significance of the reflexivity of the thought of analysis, of philosophy, if you wish, of the activity, because this is how the urban activity looked in Russia. Practice was much, much forward compared to theory. So I think the development of theory is actually needed. And it's a difficult task for me of making my personal / professional activity a research subject for me as a researcher. And it's difficult to change the optics, so to say, to take this point of view, to look at yourself as a representative of a community, a professional community that has been performing the particular activity. And now I'm trying to make it a research topic, a subject of what this community have been doing, what it has not been doing, what was missing, what was the focus, and so on and so forth. So that's my research topic for now, actually, and I'm still learning how to take this position as a researcher. And also it's difficult in terms of building a communication with your former colleagues who are, well, they are still colleagues, yeah, with who we have been practicing urbanism, so to say. And now, on the one hand, these relations give me very good access to the field. So I can talk to most of those people who are considered to be like real establishers of the urbanist agenda in Russia. But on the one hand, but on the other hand, we are colleagues, and it's difficult to transform this relation into a researcher expert position, for example. To make an expert interview with them is kind of ridiculous for both of us. So it's difficult, methodological difficulty that I'm struggling with now. But there are also advantages, I think, in this position. And my belief is that in the next years there will be a real need to think of to kind of enrich the urban studies, the Russian urban studies, with intellectual thought, with lots of analysis of the practice. So this is my task for now. And I think that I can see that many people, especially those who left, they share this point of view, and they agree with my critical statements that I've already made several times about this activity and the professional community. So there is also a little clash now. So those who stayed, they still believe what they do, what makes sense, what they did before also made sense. So they do not see like a need for drastical change in their activity. But those who left, they rather share my point of view that there is a need for drastical change based on the reflexivity and analysis of our own practice. And also I think that the issue of political is now the issue. The relations between the urbanism and political, it has always been underestimated. It almost never existed, and most of Russian post-Soviet Russian urbanism was positioning itself as out of politics. So like claiming we are out of politics, we are non-political, we do urban environment was kind of very, very common position. And I think that was a part of the problem or a part of the professional responsibility. So we as professionals could make our input in the development of political, and we almost didn't. Not didn't at all, that's not true, we did, but to a much less degree or extent than we could if we did it consciously. So I think this is, for example, one of the things that has to be changed, the bringing political, not politics, but political to urbanism. So I think this is the next several years of work of the professional communities. And in practical sense, the activist work, it's now lots of things to be done for establishing, reestablishing and keeping networks of activists, keeping connections between those who left and those who stayed, trying to understand the agenda, the new agenda of those who stays in Russia, trying to help them in all possible ways. Perhaps in the future, as soon as it will be possible, also establishing the conditions well, it really looks like it can sound as a metaphor, but I really see it like two, you know, pieces of fabric cut in two, and now you have to sew them together. Mm. So with these travel trips there and back, with activities, events organized, one in Russia, one outside of Russia, with the same people, bringing them together, talking about what is important for them. All these kind of things are, yeah, the activities aimed at keeping Russian civil society, at least in some way, in some form, for its further development, just connecting this point to the previous one, perhaps developing it in the same way as we all did in the last 20, 30 years, is not the best way. I mean, it would be repeating the same mistake, so to say. Or not all of that was mistake, but definitely it was not the best, not the proper way of developing civil society or public sphere in Russia, because all what we've built within 20 years has been demolished in 2 weeks. How is it possible? It should say something about the instability or inconsistency or weakness of those structures built. So to try, let's say after Putin's regime, to try to rebuild them again in the same way doesn't seem the best option, because there was something weak in that model. So again, we should do analysis also of this, the civil society and public sphere development in these kind of regimes, countries, because we see it's repeating, it's a little bit of history repeating. So it can repeat again, maybe in 20, 30 years, if we continue doing the same way. We probably should do something different also in this sphere. So the first task is to understand, to analyze and understand what exactly could be done different, and then turning to practice mm-hmm. of doing it different.
All right, last open question to you. With respect of urban studies outside of Russia. Okay. So what kind of questions and challenges do you see that the war and the situation of critical scholars and activists in Russia and from Russia raise?
Well, one of the things that was discussed a lot. Well, it's rather connected to Ukraine than to Russia, because what war does to the cities, yeah, is the demolition, and what's going on to the East Ukrainian cities now is terrible. But what can happen after can be as terrible as what's going on now, and this is what I mean is the leftist critics of neoliberal development of the cities, like very much like Harvey. Kind of ideas, and critique, well, what can happen to Ukrainian cities is just they're total restoration in a radical neoliberal way, and the cities will belong to the world financial institutions like World Bank or Monetary Foundation and all these kind of institutions that will invest in restoration of the cities with all the neoliberal consequences, yeah, so to say. So even for example, as far as I know, the situation in Ukraine with ownership and renting housing was similar to Russia, so most of people were owners, which prevented from gentrification. I guess that if nothing will be done against it, then the situation in the new Ukraine is going to look like in GDR, like in East European countries with terrible gentrification
happening. Privatization.
Through privatizing, but not privatizing by the people who live, but bigger financial institutions. Yeah, so now owners are people who live there. It used to be. And now the houses are destroyed. New houses will be built for somebody's money, and this somebody will be an owner, I guess. So this model, I think, has very bad consequences for urban way of life in Ukraine. I think that another issue is, well, I guess that the war will provoke another boom of migration refugee studies, because now, it's a new wave, but a different type of the refugee waves, for example, from Ukraine. And here, for example, in Germany, it already is discussed also in a very critical way. The attitude towards Ukrainian refugees and, let's say, Syrian refugees, the way these two types of refugees are treated, basically being in the same situation of bombed cities and they had to leave, but they are treated in a very different way, where Ukrainians look privileged, Syrians unprivileged. So the racism staying behind it, or ethno-racism or anything. So all this kind of, anyway, that looks like a reproduction of particular type of inequality in the urban development also, or in the social development. I think this will be also an issue. What else? As I said, the issue of political in urban studies, it's not a Russian issue at all. I mean, it's discussed by French philosophers a lot, for example, or Zizek, the issue of post-political. But combination between the urban politics and the post-political is also discussed, but not that, extent. But I think Russia is just good case provoking this debate. So look what can happen if you continue the same way we did. I mean, because this neoliberalism mixed with the populism leading altogether to the authoritarianism, obviously. Russia is just forward. But the same thing are going on in Europe. I mean, look at France and the elections, look at Italy, look at Scandinavian countries, look at Berlin with the last elections, and there are perhaps you already seen the infographics for the predictions for the next elections, where I don't know, I just guessed, got the picture. It looks terrible with the growth of CDU and AfD, and the losing positions of Die Linke, almost non-existing anymore, Green and SPD are going down. So it's the same trend. We are just forward. So what the rest of the world and Europe, first of all, can learn from us is what you shouldn't do, or you shouldn't ignore, shouldn't be too technological about the urban issues, first of all. Like this now, this big debate about the next generation in Berlin, and complains that the people stop traffic.
The last generation.
The last generation. So people who glue themselves to the asphalt to attract attention to the global warming and the big hot debate about this issue. So again, one side takes political argument about that something should be done, and this is political argument. But the most of people, of course, say, well, I'm late again at my job because those stupid idiots glue them again to the asphalt. And how much money that we've all lost because of calling to police that we are paid as taxpayers. So this, this clash between the technological or technocratic argumentation on the one hand and political on the one hand is a very universal thing. And I guess the example of situation in Russia just should probably help the rest of the world to be aware about this issue.
Wow, thank you, Oleg. I'm really amazed by your openness and your reflexiveness and your detailed insights, like very concrete examples that I really wish a lot of people will hear to also understand this perspective that I think we hear far too little about. So thank you so much for taking your time.
Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.